paper on an approved topic. They would be required to appear at 4 minuet classes. And they would be obliged to host a coming-out party with several other debutantes, to which all the debutantes, parents, escorts, and members of the Alpha Debutante Committee and their wives would be invited. Charm Week was the centerpiece of the debutantes' indoctrination. The Alpha's wives, the Alphabets, taught classes in beauty and the social graces, how to plan a party, send out invitations, set a table, introduce people properly, and write thank you notes. There was a session on table manners. Butter only the piece of bread you are about to put in your mouth. If food drops to the floor, let it stay there. Call for the waiter. If you happen to put a piece of gristle in your mouth, take it out with whatever put it in. A fork, a spoon, not your fingers. The debutantes were taught ways to improve their speech. Never say axe, say ask. Axe should be axed from your vocabulary. And get rid of words like and well. They were taught how to curtsy. Don't pop up, come up slowly. How to sit gracefully. Keep your legs straight together or crossed at the ankles, never crossed at the knees. And how to walk like a lady. Back straight, shoulders up, arms to your sides, and no bopping. There was a set of criteria for the debutantes' escorts, too. It boiled down to two requirements. They had to be high school graduates currently in college or the military, and they could not have been convicted of a felony. Lining up escorts was not an easy matter. Boys tended to regard being an escort as more of a chore than an honor. They balked at attending the dance classes, renting a tailcoat, and going to so many parties where the chaperones tended to outnumber the young people. It was not unusual, therefore, for a debutante's boyfriend to beg off, and for the debutante to be escorted by someone who had been pressed into service, an older brother, the son of a graduate alpha, or one of the current undergraduate alphas. At noon on the day of the ball, the 25 debutantes arrived at the Hyatt Regency for a dress rehearsal, carrying their gowns in garment bags. They went upstairs to a suite of rooms reserved as dressing rooms, and after changing, they came down to the ballroom, where their fathers and their escorts were waiting to rehearse the waltz and the minuet. The Alpha Ball was to be a more modest affair than the Cotillion Ball the next night. There would be 2 cash bars instead of 5 open bars. There would be a breakfast served at 1 a.m., instead of both a dinner and a breakfast, and there would be minimal decorations. Nonetheless, the impending affair was not going unnoticed in the hotel. During the dress rehearsal, a cluster of curious onlookers peered through the door, captivated by the sight of so many young black girls in flowing white ball gowns. One of the observers, a man in a gray suit and tan shoes, called attention to the cases of wine and liquor being unpacked at the far end of the ballroom. "Don't kid yourself," he said with a knowing air. "Blacks drink better whiskey than whites do. Dewars, Johnny Walker, Seagram's, Hennessy, all the high-priced brands. I have a theory about why that is." The man cupped the elbow of his pipe-holding arm and rocked back on his heels, glancing to his right and left, to satisfy himself that the people standing in his immediate vicinity were paying sufficient attention. He then delivered himself of a peculiarly homespun theory. "Remember when the black athletes at the Mexico City Olympics won a lot of medals and raised their fists in the black power salute? Well, that's when blacks in Savannah started drinking Dewar's Scotch, Seagram's Gin, and Smirnoff Vodka. If you look at those bottles, you'll notice that all the labels have medals on them. Blacks had suddenly begun to identify with medals because of the Olympics, and that's why they bought those brands. At about the same time, they also started drinking Hennessy Cognac. The Hennessy label has a picture of a hand holding a mace, something like the Black Power salute. Johnny Walker Scotch has a man with riding breeches and a top hat, which represents the good life. It all has to do with the symbol on the label. The best example of that was when school integration was taking place. That's when blacks started drinking teacher's scotch, which has a label showing a professor wearing a mortarboard. They go for the symbol, you see? At least, that's the way I figure it. Toward 9 o'clock, the Hyatt's vast atrium lobby began to fill with guests arriving for the ball. A long, steep escalator carried a stately stream of formally dressed black couples high above the potted trees to the ballroom on the second floor. Inside the ballroom, a string quartet played chamber music as 400 guests mingled briefly before quietly taking their places at tables around the dance floor. One table of guests, knowing that no dinner would be served, brought a carton of takeout snacks, which they started eating as soon as the lights dimmed. The president of the graduate chapter of Alpha Phi Alpha stepped to the podium dressed in the fraternity's colors, a black and gold tuxedo, a gold dress shirt, and a gold bow tie. He welcomed the gathering and bade the ceremonies begin. With the string quartet playing background music, an alphabet took the microphone and read the name of the first debutante. The debutante, escorted by her father, walked to a small platform, mounted the steps, turned toward the audience, and curtsied. The announcer called out the names of her parents, her high school, her college, and the subject in which she was majoring. Then her escort approached from the other side, took her hand, and led her down the platform as the announcer read his name and those of his parents, his school, and his major. One by one, the debutantes and their escorts were introduced in this manner. The girls each held a bouquet of yellow flowers, dotted with twinkling pin lights powered by batteries in the handle of the bouquet. The escorts were dressed in black tie, wing collar, tailcoats, and white gloves. They held their left hands behind them at the small of their backs, palm outward. At the end of the presentations, the debs and escorts stood facing each other in two long rows that filled most of the dance floor. The hall was silent for a moment. Then the string quartet struck up again. The escorts bowed in unison, and the debutantes curtsied, their gowns sweeping the floor in a foamy surf of white ruffles and lace. The couples then joined hands and moved forward in a graceful promenade, dancing a lilting minuet to the strains of Don Giovanni. The room seemed to rise and fall with each gliding step. It was almost as if they were skating. A current of exhilaration coursed throughout the room. Women held their breath. Men stared in wonder. At the table of honor, Dr. Collier smiled from ear to ear, his joy shared by all. When the minuet was done, the debutantes danced two waltzes, first with their fathers, then with their escorts. After that, the string quartet packed up and left, and the Bobby Lewis Band began setting up for ballroom dancing. Dr. Collier had put me at a table with several alphas and alphabets. In the afterglow of the minuet, the alphas were beaming with pride. One of the women mentioned that the local chapter of the Lynx, the most prestigious black women's civic and social organization in the United States, had expressed a desire to preside over the Savannah debutante proceedings, as they did in Atlanta and other cities. But the alphas would not give it up. "The AKAs want to sponsor it, too," another woman said, referring to the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority. Although the woman was an alphabet, she was also an AKA, and it was clear she had mixed feelings on the issue. "This has been a long-running battle," she said. "We women feel the matter of debutantes should be our prerogative. It should not be left to a male fraternity." The three alphas at the table laughed contentedly. "If we gave it up," one of them said, "we'd lose our status." "We can't do that." The women exchanged silent looks. One of them pointedly changed the subject. "My, isn't that a lovely gown," she said, gazing across the room. I turned and looked in the direction she was facing. An elegant black woman was standing at the entrance to the hall, peering uncertainly into the room as if looking for someone. She wore a slim-fitting dark blue evening gown with a solid mass of rhinestones glittering across the top. I turned back to my table, but something about the figure in the doorway, something about the rhinestones and the way the woman held her head haughtily in the air, made me take a second look. Sure enough, it was Chablis. At the moment I saw her, she saw me. She took a deep breath, raised her chin a little higher, and started walking toward me at an exaggeratedly regal pace. Her eyes were locked onto mine, and her lips were pursed in a fashion model-style pout. She was playing the Lady Chablis, the Grand Empress of Savannah. The crowd parted for her as she approached, all eyes on her. I felt a sudden throbbing in my head and a ringing in my ears. She was not more than 5 steps away from me when she reached out a slender, gloved arm. I saw it as the Grim Reaper's scythe swinging toward me. At the last moment, she turned to the right and clasped the forearm of a muscular teenager standing next to my chair. "Young man," she said, "can you help me?" She looked plaintively into his eyes. "I am a damsel in distress, I surely am." The young man broke into a handsome smile. "I can try, ma'am," he said. "What's the problem?" Chablis turned her shoulders slightly so she could see me as she spoke. "I am here alone," she said. "I do not have the slightest idea who invited me. I am serious. My social secretary took down the information and wrote it on a piece of paper, but I left the paper in the limousine and sent my driver away. He won't be back till midnight." Chablis entwined both of her hands around the young man's biceps. "And you know how it is with us ladies," she purred. "We must never be alone. That is not acceptable in polite society. We must always have a man by our side."
"I know what you mean, ma'am," he said.
"So I was hoping you would stay by me till I can find my host," she said. "And you can quit calling me ma'am. My name is Chablis. What's yours?"
"Philip, I'm an escort."
"Ooh, child, an escort! You mean you work for one of those dating services?"
"No, no," he said. "See, all the debutantes here have escorts. I'm here with a debutante."
"Oh, I see. Which one is yours?"
"She's standing that group over there. It's my sister."
Chablis drew back in surprise.
"Child, you have got to be kidding. You mean to tell me you're doing it with your sister?"
"No, no, no," Philip said. "You got it all wrong. See, Gregory, that's my sister's boyfriend, he flat refused to come to this thing. He said, 'No way, I'm not going,' so I got roped into coming instead. That's how it works sometimes."
"Oh, now I understand," said Chablis. "You're just filling in, huh? You ain't got a real date tonight, do you?"
She leaned closer to him, her hands gently stroking his arm.
"Well, that's sort of true," he said.
"Tell me something, child. Are you carrying a gun?"
"A gun? No, I don't mess with that stuff."
"That's good. I didn't think you did, honey. But you see, one time I was out with a very high-class gentleman, and he put a gun to my head, so I always like to ask."
"I don't think you'll run up against any guns in this ballroom," said Philip. "Everybody here is pretty law-abiding."
"You've never even been arrested? Not even once?"
"Well," Philip smiled shyly, "one time, sorta."
"Ooh, tell me, tell me, tell me. What was it for? Drugs? Reefer? 'Cause I am simply dying for a drag on a..."
"No, it wasn't much. Me and a couple of guys had a few too many drinks one night, and we kinda, you know, disturbed the peace a little."
"Ooh,
I bet you did. I bet you could disturb that peace real bad if you wanted to. I can see it now, yes.
Chablis shuddered with pleasure. She was now massaging Philip's arm.
Oh, look, she said. Here comes Mother Superior headed this way.
That's my sister, said Philip. Chablis loosened her grip on the young man's arm as a tall debutante in a lace gown approached.
Chablis, this is my sister Lavella, he said. Lavella, this is Chablis.
Lavella wore her hair in bangs and a pageboy cut. Chablis offered her hand.
We was just talking about you, she said. I understand y'all going to college.
Yes, I'm a freshman at Savannah State, Lavella said with a perky smile. I'm majoring in electrical engineering.
Really, child, electrical engineering?
See, now, that's something I wish I knew how to do. Last week my TV broke down right in the middle of The Young and the Restless, and all I could think to do was kick it. That didn't help none at all. Of course, I never got to go to college. I had private tutors from kindergarten right on up. It doesn't matter now, though. I'm in show business, and I go on tour most of the time.
Oh, said Lavella, that sounds so glamorous. You get to travel to so many places.
Travel does have its points, said Chablis.
See this little handbag?
Chablis held up a beaded clutch purse that twinkled in the light.
I got it in London.
Oh, it's so beautiful, said Lavella. And my shoes are from Rome. And let's see, the gloves are from Paris, and the gown is from New York.
Gosh, said Lavella,
we've all been admiring your gown. It's exquisite.
Well, honey, you too can have clothes like this if you play your cards right.
I guess I better start saving up right now, said Lavella.
Oh, no, uh-uh.
Chablis waved a finger.
That is not the way to do it. Never spend any of your own hard-earned money on clothes and accessories. You need to get yourself a man to buy all of that for you.
Chablis put her hands on Philip's arm again.
You need to have a talk with that boyfriend of yours. What's his name? Gregory? The one that refused to come with you tonight? And you need to tell Gregory to get ready to shake loose some of his coins and buy you gowns and finery.
I can try, Lavella said with a rueful smile, but I don't think it'll work.
Then I guess you'll just have to get all this shit the way I did, said Chablis. Shoplifting.
Before Lavella could respond, Chablis took Philip by the arm and led him toward the dance floor.
"'Excuse us, Miss Thang,' she said. "'Me and Philip is about to disturb the peace a little.'
My first thought was to flee immediately, before Chablis had a chance to make it known that I was more or less responsible for her presence. She had a devilish smirk on her face. She was in her glory. She pressed against Philip's body as they spun around the floor. They moved as one, not so much dancing as writhing to the beat. The rhinestones on Chablis' dress sparkled in the light and set her face aglow. I recognized it as the dress I had zipped her into backstage at the pickup, the one with the slit up the back. Every so often the slit parted, revealing a whole haunch of calf, thigh, and buttock. So far, Chablis' antics had gone unnoticed, but I doubted they would remain unnoticed for long, considering the deep backward dips she was now executing, not to mention the full-throttle bumps and grinds. I got up from my chair and headed for the door, but my path was obstructed by an exuberant Dr. Collier.
"There you are," he said. "I've been looking for you. What did you think of the minuet?"
"It was stunning," I said. "And I want to thank you so much for inviting me. It was very kind of you. I've had a lovely time." Dr. Collier had me firmly by the arm. He was looking around the room.
"I want to introduce you to the man that taught him how to do it. He's the athletic director at Savannah State, John Miles. He taught him the waltz, too.
I don't see him just now, but that's okay. We'll catch him a little later.
I now had a choice of slipping away and insulting my host, or staying and becoming entangled in Chablis' inevitable denouement. I withdrew to the bar nearest the door to figure out what to do next. From that vantage point, I had a view of the dance floor and a clear shot at the exit. I ordered a double scotch.
"And I'll have an apple schnapps," said Chablis, suddenly materializing beside me.
She was breathing heavily and dabbing her face with a napkin. "What happened to your friend Philip?" I asked.
"His sister cut in on us," she said with a look of extreme distaste. "But that's all right, honey. I'll get even with her. And anyway, I don't mind. The doll has her eye on a couple of the other escorts now. Soon as she gets a little liquid fire in her belly, she'd be getting into the cutting-in business herself, big time."
The bartender set a shot glass of apple schnapps in front of Chablis. She drank it in a single gulp and coughed. Her eyes blazed. She looked out over the dance floor and her mouth twisted into a leer.
"Eeny, meeny, miny, moe. Catch an escort by the toe. Isn't that how the little ditty goes, honey? Did I get it right? Did I? Hey, Mr. Chauffeur, are you listening to me?"
"Forgive me, Chablis," I said, "but I think you have a hell of a nerve busting in here like this."
"Ooh, I have made you angry, baby. You are some kind of cute when you get mad, child. But see, baby, the doll felt like being a little uppity tonight. And this ballroom happens to be the uppityest place in Savannah at the moment. That is why she is here."
"Well, let's not argue," I said. "I have no intention of insulting these people. And if you're planning to pull any more pranks, I'd appreciate it if you'd stay well away from me. Better yet, why don't you just leave now, before things get out of hand? You've had your fun. Why ruin it?"
"Ooh, but the fun's just starting, honey."
"Well, it's all over for me," I said. "I'm leaving."
"Oh, no, you ain't, child. 'Cause if you do, I will read your beads right here in public, I promise you. I will scream and carry on. I will go up to that old man in the blue ruffled shirt you was just talking to, and I will tell him that you brought me here, and that I am carrying your baby, and that you have just walked out on me."
Every hair follicle on my head began to tingle. I was too respectful of Chablis' sense of drama to dismiss her threat out of hand. She smiled and moved closer to me.
"This is what you get for not bringing me as your date," she said. "But if you are a good boy, I promise I won't say nothing."
"Just behave yourself, Chablis," I said.
"I'll try, honey," she said. "But it ain't going to be easy. Whenever I'm around high yellers, I get jumpy. Know what I mean? And this place is loaded with 'em. Just look around."
Chablis leaned on an elbow and scanned the crowd, panning slowly from one end of the hall to the other.
"What you are looking at is black society," she said. "And now you know the big secret about black society. The whiter you are, the higher you get to rise in it."
"But the debutantes don't all have light skin," I said. "They represent a pretty broad mix, if you ask me."
"They can make debutantes in any color they want," said Chablis, "but it won't make any difference. The girls with the light skin are the ones the successful black men are going to marry. It gives them status. Black may be beautiful, honey, but white is still right when it comes to getting ahead in this world, in case you didn't know. I ain't got nothing against high yellers. Their color ain't their fault, but they do tend to clan together. You ought to see him at St. Matthew's Episcopal Church on West Broad Street. That's the black status church here in Savannah. People say they got a comb over the front door, and they won't let you in unless you can run the comb through your hair without breaking it.
Inside the church, the real light-skinned people sit in the pews up front, and the darker ones sit in the back.
That's right, honey. Just like it used to be on the buses. You see, when it comes to prejudice, black folks are right up there with white folks. Believe me. It's no big deal. But when I see black folks start acting white, honey, it brings out the nigger bitch in me.
A sly smile crept over Chablis' face. She peered seductively over her shoulder at me.
"Behave yourself," I said.
Chablis ordered another apple schnapps and drank it down.
"We gotta stop talking now, child. It's time for the doll to go play with the boys."
Chablis walked demurely onto the dance floor and tapped the shoulder of the first debutante who passed. She and the debutante exchanged polite smiles and traded places. In a moment, Chablis was nestled against the chest of her new dancing partner. I watched from the bar, my anxiety tempered somewhat by my double scotch. 5 minutes later, Chablis disentangled herself from her new partner and cut in on another couple. She did this several times in the next half hour, working the room and rubbing up against all the best-looking young men. She took care as she made her rounds not to neglect the feelings of the debutantes.
"Love the gown," she would say as she cut in.
Chablis' mouth was moving as fast as her body. She whispered to her partners and gossiped with the girls. At 1 o'clock, the dancing came to an end, and a breakfast buffet was laid out. Chablis filled her plate with eggs and sausages, and then, as people began to sit down at their appointed tables, she floated around the room, looking for a place to alight. Before long, I noticed she was floating in our direction. She scooped an empty chair from the next table and dragged it over to ours, squeezing it in between the two matrons who were sitting opposite me. They obligingly made room for her.
"Oh, pardon me," said Chablis. "Is it all right if I join you?"
"Why, certainly," said one of the women. "I must tell you I have not been able to take my eyes off your beautiful gown all night. It makes you look like a movie star."
"Thanks," said Chablis, settling into her seat. "As a matter of fact, I wear it on stage a lot."
"Oh, are you in the theater?" the woman asked.
"Yes, I'm an actress," said Chablis.
"How fascinating. What sort of acting do you do?"
"Shakespeare, Broadway, lip sync. I'm based in Atlanta, but I came to Savannah tonight so I could see my cousin become a debutante."
"Oh, how nice," said the woman. "Which one is she?"
"Lavella."
"Oh, Lavella's a lovely girl. Don't you think so, Charlotte?"
"Oh, my, yes," said the other woman, nodding and smiling broadly.
"I think so, too," said Chablis, a saccharine sweetness creeping into her voice. "And she's always wanted to be a debutante, ever since I can remember."
Chablis ate her food with exaggerated gentility, both pinkies raised.
"Isn't that sweet?" said the woman.
"Lavelle is so delicate and pretty, and so intelligent."
"She's wanted it so bad. We used to talk about being debutantes when we was kids," said Chablis. "I'm so glad she got to be one. She was afraid she wouldn't make it, though."
"Well," said the woman, "I can tell you Lavelle had nothing to worry about. She's a first-class young lady." "She was worried anyhow. She'd say to me, 'Oh, Cousin Chablis, I'll never make it. I know I'll never make it.' And I would say, 'Now listen, girl, you got nothing to worry about. If Vanessa Williams can get to be Miss America in spite of all the checking up they do at the Miss America pageant, you ought to be able to slide right by that two-bit debutante screening committee in little old Savannah.'"
The two matrons glanced across Chablis at each other.
"Besides, Lavella, honey," I said, "you are always so careful to save your hoarding around for when you come to Atlanta.
No one in Savannah has a clue.
The two women stared wordlessly at Chablis, who continued to eat her breakfast daintily while she talked.
I wanted to be a debutante, too, she went on. Oh, yes, I really did. But like I said to Lavella, if I'm going to be a debutante, let me be a real debutante. Let me be a cotillion debutante. I am serious.
One of the women coughed. The other looked away from the table in desperation, as if searching the horizon for a rescue ship.
Oh, sure, Lavella, I said. The Alpha Ball is very beautiful and glamorous, don't get me wrong. But Lavella, I said, what are you going to do this summer when you get off from school, huh? You're going to work at the Burger King on West Broad Street, right? Well, honey, cotillion debutantes do not work at the Burger King. No way, child. They take bicycle trips through France and England. I am serious. They go to Washington and work for a United States senator who happens to be a friend of the family. They sail on a yacht. They fly to a spa and lay on their asses all summer. That's what they do, and that's what I want to do as a debutante.
Chablis pretended not to notice the discomfort she was causing the women. She glanced at me briefly and pursed her lips. Then she went right on talking.
So I said, go ahead and laugh, girl, but you know I really could be a cotillion debutante if I wanted to be, 'cause I'm so good at passing. I can be whatever I choose to be, and if I choose to be a rich white girl, honey, that's what I will be. God knows I'm halfway there already. I have plenty of blonde hunks to play with, honey, and I'm working on having me a white baby.
The women gave me pained glances, embarrassed that I, the only white person in the ballroom, should be forced to hear such talk. The temperature in the room seemed to rise by 60 degrees. I was sure my face was bright red. Suddenly, Chablis put down her knife and fork.
Oh, my goodness, she said. What time is it?
She grabbed the hand of the woman next to her and looked at her watch.
1:30? My driver's been waiting for me since midnight.
She glanced around the room, then pushed her chair away from the table and stood up.
Well, it's been nice meeting you, she said. I gotta say goodbye to some people before I go. If you ladies happen to see my chauffeur, would you tell him I'm still here and not to leave without me? Tell him we'll be taking my cousin with us. My other cousin, that is. Philip. Tell him Philip and me haven't finished disturbing the peace yet. He'll know what that means.
Yes. Why, certainly, one of the women mumbled.
And you won't have any trouble spotting my chauffeur, said Chablis, casting a glance my way. He's white.
Then she set off around the room, table hopping and slipping her telephone number to several of the boys. Now, I figured, was the time for me to leave. Quickly. I nodded goodbye to my table mates and headed toward the door, giving Chablis a wide berth. I knew that if she saw me, she would draw me into whatever stunt she was about to pull. I approached Dr. Collier and hurriedly thanked him for inviting me. Dr. Collier didn't sense the urgency of my departure and introduced me to the man standing next to him, the man who had taught the debutantes how to dance the minuet. I smiled and uttered pleasantries, but barely heard a word that either of the two were saying. My eyes were darting around the room for signs of Chablis. When at last it was possible to take my leave, I withdrew, ducked around the bar, slipped through the ballroom doors, and bounded down the escalator 2 steps at a time. I managed to make it across the lobby without incident, and dashed out the front door into a calm, untroubled, misty night on Bay Street. Chapter 25. Talk of the Town. Midway through Jim Williams's 2nd year in jail, Savannah more or less forgot about him. The city turned its attention to other topics. There was a good deal of talk, for example, about the divine intervention allegedly visited upon George Mercer III. George Mercer III was a prominent businessman and the nephew of the late Johnny Mercer. Mr. Mercer was leaving his house in Ardsley Park one evening to go to a dinner party when he suddenly realized he'd forgotten his car keys. He went back inside to get them. In the front hall, he heard a voice say loud and clear, "George, you drink too much." Mr. Mercer looked around, but the hall was empty. "Who are you?" he said. "And where are you?" "I am the Lord," said the voice. "I am everywhere." "Well, I know I drink more than I should," said Mr. Mercer. "But how do I know you're the Lord? If you really are, show me. Show me now. If you can prove to me you're God, I'll never drink again." Suddenly, Mr. Mercer felt himself being lifted high in the air. Up over his house. Up over Ardsley Park. He was lifted so high he could look down and see all of Savannah. The downtown squares, the river, Tybee Island, and Hilton Head. And the voice said, "Have I proved to you that I am real?" Mr. Mercer declared then and there that he did believe, and the Lord put him back down in the front hall. George Mercer III never took another drink after that. Even people who doubted the truth of that story had to admit that on a spiritual level at least, something very strange was happening to Savannah's upper crust. How else could one explain the charismatic services Thursday nights at Christ Episcopal Church? Christ Church was Savannah's oldest and most tradition-bound house of worship. It was the mother church of Georgia, John Wesley having served as its rector in 1736. But now, the charismatics had a foot in the door, and they were gathering in the basement on Thursday nights, speaking in tongues, strumming guitars, banging on tambourines, and waving their arms in the air whenever the Spirit moved them. The more conservative parishioners were appalled. Some simply refused to believe it. Spiritual matters were not Savannah's only preoccupation, however. There was concern about the city's economy as well. Savannah's renaissance had crested, and a decline had begun. The city seemed more isolated than ever. Northern businesses were relocating in the south, but they were putting down roots in Atlanta, Jacksonville, and Charleston, not in Savannah. Downtown real estate values, after rising sharply for 20 years, had softened. Retail stores were abandoning Broughton Street and moving out to the mall and elsewhere on the south side. More ominous yet, it seemed that Savannah's most lucrative source of income, the shipping business, was on the verge of being choked off by, of all things, the old Talmadge Bridge. As tall as the bridge was, it wasn't quite tall enough to allow the huge new super freighters to sail under it to the docks upriver. Several medium-sized container ships had already clipped off aerials and radar masts on the underside of the bridge, and port officials dreaded that any day now a whole poop deck would be sheared off into the water. Before that ever happened, of course, a fair portion of Savannah's shipping trade would have headed for other ports. The threat to the economy of Savannah and Georgia was grave enough to send the state's congressional delegation scrambling in search of federal funds for a new bridge. After a period of tense negotiations, money was allotted, and a potential calamity averted. Fears about the old bridge were replaced by curiosity about what the new one would look like. With matters like these to talk about, there was little time for thoughts of Jim Williams. "After all," sighed Millicent Moreland, "what more is there to say except, poor Jim?" Indeed, a more immediate concern was the sudden appearance on downtown walls, sidewalks, and dumpsters of graffiti that read, "A Disturbed Jennifer." The desperate nature of the scrawl suggested that a deranged woman was roaming the lanes, contemplating harm to herself or others. After a month of heightened anxiety and double locking of doors, a disturbed Jennifer materialized as a rock group composed of 4 green-haired students from the Savannah College of Art and Design. The resolution of that mystery calmed fears, but did nothing to soothe Savannah's increasing impatience with the new art school. The Savannah College of Art and Design, known familiarly as SCAD, had opened its doors in 1979 with the blessings of all Savannah. The school had taken over the boarded-up guard armory on Madison Square and refurbished it as classrooms and studios for 71 art students. Within 2 years, enrollment had climbed to 300, and the college had acquired and restored several more old and empty buildings, warehouses, public schools, even a jailhouse. SCAD's young president, Richard Rowan, let it be known that the student body would eventually grow to 2,000. Downtown residents did not respond happily to Rowan's announcement. While the students did contribute something to the local economy, and they did bring a little life to the otherwise empty streets, they were becoming, in the eyes of some people, a blight on the landscape with their green hair, their odd clothes, their skateboards, and their tendency to play loud music on their stereos well into the night. In reaction, a group of downtown residents formed a quality of life committee to deal with the situation. Joe Webster, who headed the committee, could be seen each day at noontime, walking stiffly with the aid of a cane from his office in the CNS Bank building to the Oglethorpe Club for lunch. His route took him down Bull Street, past the main entrance of SCAD, where he would invariably make his way through a small cluster of students and point silently with his cane at some offending object, a crumpled candy wrapper or a motorcycle idling noisily at the curb. On one occasion, Mr. Webster and his committee stopped in to see Richard Rowan in his office to express their concern that the fragile human ecology of downtown Savannah might not survive 2,000 students. The total population of the historic district was, after all, only about 10,000. Rowan told the committee that he would see what he could do about the loud music, and that, by the by, he had recently revised his goal from 2,000 students to 4,000. However disruptive the college might have been to Savannah's peace and quiet, it did nothing to harm the city's physical beauty. The college restored each building it bought with taste and authenticity, and Savannah continued to receive compliments from its far-flung admirers. Le Monde called Savannah la plus belle des villes d'Amérique du Nord. The National Trust for Historic Preservation focused a flattering spotlight on the city, when it bestowed its highest honor, the Louise Crowninshield Award, on Lee Adler for his contribution to Savannah's restoration. Adler went to Washington to accept the award, and upon his return, his fellow citizens rallied around him in customary fashion. They congratulated him for winning yet another great honor, and as soon as his back was turned, they bitterly denounced him for once again hogging sole credit for a job done by many. While Savannah had grown accustomed to receiving compliments for its good looks, the city was thoroughly unprepared for a shockingly negative piece of news about itself that came howling out of the FBI in Washington and resounded around the world. Savannah had achieved the highest per capita murder rate in the United States the previous year. 54 murders, or 22.6 murders per 100,000 people. Savannah had become the murder capital of the United States. A stunned Mayor John Roussakis looked at the figures and complained that Savannah had been the victim of a statistical fluke. The numbers reflected murder rates in metropolitan areas. Unlike most cities, Savannah did not have vast outlying suburbs with thousands of untroubled suburbanites to dilute its murder rate. When the murder rate was confined to actual city limits, Savannah ranked 15th in the nation, which was still a troubling distinction, for a city that was not even among the country's 100 largest cities. Intending to clarify the matter, the city manager, Don Mendonza, announced that a breakdown of police figures showed that crime in Savannah is a black problem. Nearly half of Savannah's population was black, he said, but 91% of the murderers were black, and 85% of the victims were also black. The same was true for rape. 89% of the offenders and 87% of the victims were black. 94% of assaults and 95% of robberies involved black offenders. The city manager was not a racist. He expressed a compassionate concern for dealing with root causes, 12.1% unemployment among blacks compared with 4.7% for whites, and similar disparities in school dropout rates, teenage pregnancies, unwed mothers, and family income. Although race inequalities were, if anything, greater in Savannah than in other southern cities, Savannah's blacks displayed surprisingly little hostility toward whites. On the surface, at least, a remarkable civility prevailed. A black man passing a white stranger on the street would be likely to nod and say, "Good morning, how you doing?" or simply, "Hey." Outwardly, little seemed to have changed since William Makepeace Thackeray visited Savannah in 1848 and described it as a tranquil old city with wide, tree-planted streets and a few happy Negroes sauntering here and there. Thackeray was not the only person to notice that slaves had smiles on their faces. W. H. Pearson wrote in The Water Witch in 1863, "The slaves are, by all odds, the happiest-looking folks in the Confederacy. They sing, while the whites curse and pray." During slavery, it was thought by some observers that the apparent good cheer of the slaves had something to do with their expectation that the roles would be reversed in the hereafter. They would be the masters, and whites would be their slaves. In the 1960s, the civil rights struggle put a temporary strain on relations, but integration was peaceful on the whole. Since then, Savannah had been governed largely by moderate whites who made it their business to stay on good terms with the black community. As a result, racial peace was maintained, and blacks remained politically conservative, which is to say, passive. There was no discernible black activism in Savannah. But it was evident that underneath their apparent complacency, Savannah's blacks were beset by an anguish and despair that ran so deep and expressed itself with such violence that it had made Savannah the murder capital of America. If Savannah's spiritual, economic, artistic, architectural, and law and order concerns were not enough to keep people's minds off Jim Williams, there were plenty of distractions on the social scene. There was talk, for instance, about a standoff at the Married Woman's Card Club. Slots for membership had opened up, but competition to fill them had become so fierce that every candidate had been blackballed for 2 years running. No one had gotten into the club in all that time, and for the first time in memory, membership had slipped below the mandated 16. The stalemate was temporarily upstaged by a food poisoning scare at one of the club's get-togethers. The ladies were just heading home at 6 o'clock, when they discovered the hostess's cat lying dead on the front steps. Someone recalled having seen the cat nibbling a leftover portion of crab casserole only minutes before. The women thereupon trotted to their cars and drove in a swarm to Candler Hospital to have their stomachs pumped. The following morning, the next-door neighbor stopped by to say he was sorry he'd run over the cat. Neither the married woman's membership crisis nor the food scare received any mention in the newspaper's society column. It was, in fact, at about this time that the newspaper announced it was discontinuing its society column altogether. The column had never been much more than a bland recitation of guest lists, but its disappearance provoked a stinging rebuke from one of Savannah's leading socialites, Mrs. Vera Dutton Strong. In her letter to the editor, which was one of the longest the newspaper had ever published, Mrs. Strong expressed shocked disbelief at the cancellation of the column, calling the paper's social coverage a genuine disgrace. There was a certain irony in this, because the most compelling social gossip at the moment happened to be the test of wills currently being waged by Mrs. Strong and her rebellious daughter, Dutton. Vera Dutton Strong was an heiress to the huge Dutton pulpwood fortune. An only child, she was a member of one of Savannah's richest society families. Her mother and father had always dressed for dinner, black tie and evening gown. Throughout her childhood, she had been known as the Princess, a nickname that seemed only natural for her. She was debutante of the year, and at her wedding, she wore an exact replica of the gown Queen Elizabeth II had worn at her wedding. Over the years, Mrs. Strong had shown herself to be good-humored, warm-hearted, and strong-willed. She was a founder of the Savannah Ballet Company and served as its hovering benefactress. Each year, just before the cotillion ball, society mothers would send their debutante daughters to Vera Strong so that she could teach them how to curtsy properly. A cloistered Savannian of the purest sort, Mrs. Strong had never been to Europe, and she was past 50 when she visited Charleston for the first time. Mrs. Strong's own daughter, Dutton, was an angel-faced beauty with long red hair and not the slightest inclination to be a princess or a ballerina, both of which Mrs. Strong had set her heart on. Dutton obediently started ballet lessons at the age of 4, and soon she was dancing with her mother's ballet company. Dutton's debutante party was the only one ever held at the Telfair Museum. Vera Strong hired Peter Duchin and his orchestra and commissioned a 12-foot ice sculpture of the Eiffel Tower to highlight the April in Paris theme of the party. It was not until Dutton went away to school that a streak of independence began to assert itself. She skipped classes, stopped dancing, and finally dropped out of school. She came back to Savannah, where she spent a year aimlessly hanging around the house and doing battle with her mother. "I never wanted to be a ballerina," Dutton would bellow. "You're the one who wanted to be a ballerina." But Mrs. Strong would have none of it.
"That's nonsense. You loved dancing, or you never would have been so good at it."
After one especially energetic quarrel, Dutton stormed out of the house and moved into an apartment with an older woman who had been her mother's poodle breeder. Dutton cut her long hair short, took to wearing jeans instead of skirts, put on weight, and stopped wearing lipstick. Then, one afternoon, she came to see her mother to announce that she had at long last decided on a career. She would go to the police academy and become a Savannah cop. Vera Strong took the news with uncharacteristic calm.
"If that's what you really want," she said, "I pray it turns out to be everything you're hoping for."
Mrs. Strong attended her daughter's graduation at the police academy with a pasted-on smile. She wore the same smile at Christmas dinner, when her daughter, the former ballerina debutante, arrived wearing a navy blue polyester pantsuit with a .38-caliber revolver on one hip and a mace can and handcuffs on the other. Refusing to admit defeat, Vera Strong decided to view her daughter's choice of profession as a selfless gesture of civic-mindedness, rather than a betrayal of the family heritage. In the spring, she called the Oglethorpe Club to reserve a table for Easter dinner, making a point of telling the club manager that Dutton would be going on duty immediately afterward and would therefore be in uniform. Sensing a crisis of protocol, the manager demurred and said he would have to confer with the board. 10 minutes later, he called back with profound apologies. The no-trousers rule for women had never been lifted before, and the board dared not do it now. Mrs. Strong forthwith denounced the manager, the board, and the Oglethorpe Club as only she could do. She then slammed down the telephone and booked a table at the more amenable but less exclusive Chatham Club. The Savannah Morning News proved to be more tractable than the Oglethorpe Club. Stung by Mrs. Strong's vituperative letter, the paper reinstated its society gossip column. Understandably, the column never made reference to the red-headed ballerina and her astonishing leap from Coppelia to Cop, or to the continuing anguish that it caused her mother. While all this was going on, the controversy over Joe Odom and the Hamilton Turner House continued unabated. Shortly after Joe set up the non-profit Hamilton Turner Museum Foundation to shield his illegal tour business, his neighbors countered by arguing before the Department of Inspections that, profit or non-profit, the Hamilton Turner House stood within 100 yards of a school. This meant it was illegal for Joe to sell liquor at his luncheons and dinner parties. But Joe was not concerned. "The law says I can't sell liquor," he said. "It doesn't say I can't serve it." Somewhere in the gray area between selling and serving, Joe knew how to make money giving liquor to his customers, and he went right on doing it. Liquor also played a part in a small drama involving Serena Dawes. Serena and Luther Driggers had split up, and Serena had taken to cruising the docks late at night in an effort to pick up Greek sailors. One night, the police spotted her driving erratically along River Street and stopped her. Serena opted for a pose of elegant femininity, which was a feat in itself, since she was wearing a shorty nightgown and fluffy white rabbit-head slippers. She batted her eyelashes and exclaimed sweetly that she had gone out to move her car and had gotten lost. When the policeman took her to the county jail and booked her for driving under the influence, she wanted to scream and scratch their faces, but instead she held herself in check and coyly thanked them for coming to her rescue. She mentioned that her great-granddaddy-in-law had been ambassador to the court of St. James, just to let them know they were dealing with a woman of quality. An hour later, Luther Driggers came down to bail her out, but by that time Serena had had enough of pretense. A fat black prison matron, who had taken Serena's handbag and searched it, now handed it back to her. "You can have it back," the matron said. "It's clean." "It is not clean any more," Serena snapped, snatching the purse out of the woman's hands. "And if I ever catch you putting your filthy fucking hands on anything of mine again, you'll be wearing your poontang for a turtleneck." These, then, were the matters of consuming interest in Savannah, the city Le Monde had called La Plus Belle de Ville in North America. Beautiful it was, but still very isolated and, because of that, a bit too trusting. Police had recently circulated a warning about a pair of con men who were cashing checks drawn on a non-existent company. The con men had given their victims a sporting chance by naming their bogus company Fly By Night Incorporated, but dozens of Savannah merchants had cashed the checks anyway. About the same time, it also came to light that the clerk in charge of handling the money in probate court didn't know how to multiply, and that one of the probate judges had taken advantage of the situation by dipping into the cash box. Life, in other words, went on. Savannah had community questions to resolve, such as, should a second mall be built? Had Mr. Charles Hall ruined Whitfield Square by painting his gingerbread house a dozen shades of pink and purple? And if so, did the city have the right to force him to repaint it in more acceptable colors? Then, one day in June, all of these questions were overshadowed by the news that the Georgia Supreme Court had once again overturned Jim Williams's conviction for murder. The court cited two reasons for setting aside the conviction. First, it ruled that Judge Oliver should not have allowed a Savannah police detective to testify as an expert for the prosecution on points of evidence that the jurors were competent to evaluate on their own. The smeared blood on Danny Hansford's hand, the chair on his pants cuff, the fragments of paper on top of the gun. Second, the court faulted Spencer Lawton for waiting until his closing argument to demonstrate that the trigger on Hansford's gun was easy to pull rather than difficult, as the defense had claimed. In effect, said the court, Lawton's demonstration introduced new evidence, which should have been brought up during the trial itself, at which time the defense could have responded to it.